with the earth, with what was what was their experience of life, what was the meaning of thunder and lightning and sun, and some things died and babies were born, and all of this was mystery, you know. And they tried to with the simple tools they had available to them at that time, and this deep kind of spiritual, and that's what I think I meant yesterday, Mike, something about that genetic coding that was there from the beginning of that earliest tribal period has been buried in increasing levels of culture. And we have kind of divorced ourselves from any of that sort of rootedness, and there's work going on to kind of remember where we have come from, what we have come from. So that very earliest stage was, you know, a kind of human, and there are unconscious depths within us that resonate with that. That we feel wounded today, deeply wounded, because we know something is wrong. We know it in our deepest gut, you know. It's not just we're being told it in by the science, we know it. We cannot enjoy and appreciate and celebrate the earth as we could at an earlier time, as our parents told us about, as our grandparents told us about. And we know it in our own life. So that early stage of tribal kind of period, move on to a second stage of the great traditional civilizations. And it's here where we locate the kind of organized religious interpretation that people's shaped, gained new information, and we have at this time the emergence of Confucian China, Hindu India, Buddhist Asia, and all of the Near East. We have the Toltec, the Mayan, the Aztec, the Puebla, and the Inca civilizations of Central and South America. And we have medieval Europe, our own kind of rooted, our own most kind of final expression of the Christian tradition. And all those religious kind of formulations came at a certain period, more or less. And Tom Berry would say that period is over. You know, we have, the human species has kind of given its definitions in this kind of organized, formalized religious way, through those great streams of religious meaning that have interpreted life for people for hundreds, thousands of years. And we've lived by them. And, you know, I like those of you who've lived in different religious milieus, how in 9 years in Pakistan, people, you know, we say that Jesus or the cosmic Christ, in some way that's very, you know, that our understanding of who that, what that presence is for everyone, I get thrown up against people who've never heard of Jesus Christ, do not have no sense, have a deep religious meaning in their own framework, do the things that people do out of their religious belief. You know, the Muslims pray and fast and are good to one another and take care of one another and love and serve and are patient and give alms and all of the things that I learned as a Christian, and they do it out of a different religious stream. So I'm willing to say there is a truth much bigger than any little corner on the market that we think we have. And some of that, those great religious expressions came forth at this time. A third stage in this evolution of just this species that you and I reflect, the scientific technological era, and we are such products of that 16th, 17th, 18th period of enlightenment, when the interpretation and just as a way of kind of trying to explain that, and again I speak out of more trying to translate or say again what I have learned from Tom Berry, and there may be many other explanations, but his interpretation of how in this whole unfolding story, humans trying to understand their world around them, at the time of the Black Death, around the 13th century, 1300s, the phenomenon that was being experienced, at least in the European world, was that peoples were dying in vast numbers. The cities like Florence and Venice lost half of their population in a matter of 3 or 4 months. And there was no physical explanation for that. Your neighbor died. Every side, there, can you imagine, you know, if half of Holden was taken away, and you had no explanation for that, no, you know, and the way the people, the institution in society that interpreted life for people was the religious institution. And the religious leaders explained that as God was angry. This was a punishment from on high. This kind of phenomenon of death. And some people took that, but many said, that is not an adequate explanation. We are no different from people before. We're good and bad. But that is not adequate to what has happened. And that began this kind of bifurcation of the religious stream going off and going more and more and more interior, more intranescine. Battles and further kind of, Pascal calls it boudoir religion, you know, that we got smaller and smaller and smaller, and many good things came out of that, surely a deeper understanding of the Christian meaning, but also a separation from the great questions that people began to ask. Why do things die, you know, and the whole then understanding about germs and the scientific search began, that this quest, and even Tom would say it had to separate itself from religion in order to have the freedom of exploration, that it was not completely, the explanation of life was not filtered completely through this kind of religious dimension. So this break with religion was, in a certain sense, a necessary good. But now that great period of kind of division, that really, you know, the period of the Enlightenment with Bacon, Francis Bacon, Newton, Isaac Newton, Galileo, the establishments of a understanding of the world that came out of that time, consonant with what they knew, what they could learn. It deeply, deeply shaped the ongoing kind of the grasp that we as humans have of what it is to be human. The period of the Enlightenment, I don't think we can begin to unravel how deeply that has penetrated and influenced our culture. And we come out of that. That science is the answer. And the religious stream, less and less engaged with the great questions. But what this the fourth age or the ecological age is breaking into is this coming together now of the scientists realizing they have come to kind of an aha moment. That deep within the atom is this immense life force energy. Nothing is is hard matter. It is all in motion, you know? And they are facing kind of ultimate questions that the religious stream has also been asking. And there is new opportunity for this dialogue to come together, and to bring the great religious thinkers together with the great scientific thinkers to pose the questions of our time. Immense task before the human community at this time, and to understand that all that kind of science that we have understood to be just physical stuff has its own interior life, its own interiority, and it is, you know, and it therefore in a posture in front of that, what posture do we take as species in front of that? Except one of reverence, that this, there is an other. It isn't all just matter out there. It is living in its own right. So this you know, the kind of the radical change in our mode of consciousness to find a consciousness that puts us in tune with that, to discover that within ourselves. We need a new language for that, a new sense of what it is to be human. You know, that first day I used that expression, to reinvent the human at the species level. Well, people say, you know, what is that? It is just that. That we as humans discover who we are as species in this new kind of cosmic reality. And I say, therefore, we have to learn, and Tom Berry says, and people misunderstand him in that, he says, put the Bible aside for 20 years and let us go to the revelation of the earth, because we have not explored that as equally manifestation of this sacred other. The book has tried to name it for us in one way, and a sacred way for us. And when he says put it on the shelf, he's not saying, you know, dismiss the Bible at all. But if that's our constant frame of reference, and I hear it in the debate, in the struggle this morning. And if I'm honest with you, I will say I can no longer find, after many, many years of having the Bible be the nurturance of my life, I no longer find that right now. The thing that gives me a sense of who and what God is and the mystery of life is what I am learning about life from the earth. And I, you know, at times I get terribly fearful. I feel like I'm losing something that has been so precious in my life. But I trust that this is the Spirit leading us. You know, if we say how can God be confined in a book? You know, and if we're not willing to say where follow our bliss. You know, where are you led in your drawing towards something beautiful, something simple, something? And it doesn't mean that I don't have to struggle with being good and bad. Of course I do. Of course I do. But the context within which those questions are asked has been immensely enlarged. It is not just good and bad vis-a-vis you and me, but it is good and bad vis-a-vis this earth community to which I belong and to which I am a part. And if ever on a Sunday morning I heard a homily about that, it would put me in a different posture during the week. It would support the struggle that I am in during the week. You know, as I read the papers and I'm being told that the river that I live by is being polluted, well, that's sin. And that's the kind of cosmic sin that I have to come to grips with today. It isn't, well, it builds on, of course, whether I love my neighbor. Of course it does. But it's this neighbor, the river. So that's an enlarged context for me. But unless my cosmology has been expanded so that river truly is a part of my community of life, then my language of good and bad has no meaning. If the river has no place in my life, then it is not. You can't use the language of good and bad to people. They are good people doing what is good in their own understanding, because the river is not part of who they are. It's just a thing to be used. But if the river is part of who we are, then we do not treat it like it is a thing. And that's an immense shift in consciousness. So my contention, the doing on our part, is a lot of it, to my mind, is discovery of this consciousness. And I think we do that, I mean, one way at least, is exposing ourselves to that story, to the evolution, to the revelation that the earth itself gives us. As we begin to look at the intricate, the beauty, the mystery, you know, how do those bees know to be at that bowl of sugar 6 days down the pike? You know, what is that inner mystery and maybe we can't know that, but maybe that's all part of, you know, that's part of who our family is. So when Tom says those three kind of principles that pervade all of reality, differentiation, that nothing is anything else, and each aspect of that unfolding story is essential to the story. If hydrogen had not taken the next or whatever, that burst of life had not complicated itself in a more and more complex form, helium shaping the elements, you know, the rock, where's Rick, the whole, we would not be. So each component unfolding was critical to the next step, but each step carried the seed for the next, just as we carry the seed for what will come. Differentiation, subjectivity within each of those unfolding, each particle, it has its own interiority. And all live together in a communion, the interrelatedness of all of life. And to my mind, if we as humans learn to honor that diversity, live in reverence with that interiority, and be in conscious communion with that, that is love. The universe has been on a course of love from the beginning, from its core. So we affirm diversity. Instead of saying you're different from me and therefore I got to kill you, you're different from me, and it is only in the difference between us that the whole stays alive. But historically, what has it been? People of color, those we don't like, different from us, you don't speak my language, you don't look the way I do, therefore you don't fit. Diversity is the law of the earth. If you're a gardener, you know that. You don't plant. Our whole monoculture, that we think we can kind of, you know, eliminate the very variety that keeps the universe alive. If you're a gardener, you know that. The greater the variety, the greater the chance you have of a harvest. If the peas don't grow, the carrots will. You know, but if you plant only peas, there's famine on the earth. So we turn to the earth for its message to us. And I know, you know, I know, even like exploring this, it's hard for us as Christians, because you'd say, well, you know, and at that there was a North American conference on Christianity and ecology 2 or 3 summers ago in Indiana. And one pastor stood up and he just said, you know, if I don't have the Bible, I have no reason to be in my community. People won't come. I have no church without that book. So that's a very real question for us as Christians. But I say, as Christians, unless we are faithful to the truth, you know, where is the truth that impels us forward? And we try to find, nurture, and maybe you know, maybe we struggle to find it nurtured in the Bible, but if we are constantly thrown back into the framework that of a tradition that has removed us as a people from our earth, it isn't easy to make those transitions. And I think for a lot of us, it is a real dilemma. And I don't want to say there's no place for Christianity. Of course not. But what that place is, I think we have to be terribly courageous and be open to that unknown, and be willing to take in faith to follow that truth. Matt Fox tries to get at this, I think, a little bit differently in talking more. Tom Barry is not, he doesn't claim a theological, he doesn't claim to be a theologian, he calls himself a theologian of the earth. But he has not put out his thought over 40, 50 years into the theological community as much as, he's a cultural historian, that's his kind of formal training. Cultural anthropology, taught at Fordham University for many years. And you know, he reads in Chinese and Hindi, and he has a library that just, I mean, he's kind of a unique, just a wisdom figure, and I don't wanna, you know, Tom has not struggled as much with trying to make the translation into the Christian, with the Christian stream. I think that's fair to say. No, he hasn't really tried to make that interpretation. And the woman who I think has and is doing a lot of work in this is a woman by the name of Sister Miriam Therese McGillis. And I have 9 hours of tape on her stuff. She's a student of Tom Barry's, and in some ways I think she has made it, and it will be that way. You know, if that has merit, there will be others who take that insight and work with it to make transitions for us. That isn't Tom's gift. You can't ask it of him. But others are trying to do that. And Matthew Fox comes at this as a theologian. He comes out of a theological background. He did his doctoral study on some of the medieval mystics, Meister Eckhart in particular. And, you know, he has his credentials. And he talks in his book, Original Blessing, is the one that has most kind of established him in the theological debate. He has earlier works, and many people like some of his earlier books better, but his book on Original Blessing, and his contention is, as we marked this morning, that for most of our Christian, for most ordinary Christians, the way we have understood being Christian has been to begin with the fall and redemption, that we fell as a people. And Jesus came to save us. That's been kind of but surely, and his contention is that long before we fell, there was a creation. There was this initial beautiful beginning. Original blessing preceded original sin. And yet we have kind of narrowed our understanding or our interpretation or our exploration of being Christian through the grid of original sin. You know, and we know the historical Jesus and you know that the tremendous scholarship and truthfulness and revelation that has come to us through that. But a neglect of a rootedness in creation. So he talks then about the four paths, he calls them, four ways of interpreting. He just says there's a positive path, a negative path, a creative path, and a transformative path. His four kind of, that's his grid. And there are, and I, I think I've gone on long enough. If you want, we could come back and just go walk through those and what is the kind of content of that path and what is sin, as he would see it, against that path. He does that schema, and it's very neat. And many people find, the one thing I would say about Matt in you know, is a deep conviction in him of this, the need for us, if in this ecological age, to be not only left brain people, rational, but right brain people for whom truth and revelation will come as we open our right brains and expand them from being these little prunes to developing into the lobe comparable to our left brain. So he's deeply committed to the arts, music and dance and whatever art form there is, because that's a way of knowing that is not available to us in our rational left brain. And we're very hesitant about that, but his own institute, it's called the Institute on Culture and Creation Spirituality. And he tries to marry our any kind of conference like this. You go out and draw what you think happened, or you have to, he encourages people to kind of let the whole of who you are believe that, and not just your head. And because it's California and they dance, and that's what those kooky Californians do. It's kind of they spend time out with the moon, and they reverence the cycles of the earth and try to celebrate the seasons and all of that. And people are deeply suspicious. He's flaky, he's all this stuff. Well, I mean, fine if you know. But to date, you know, he was silenced for a year, and yet none of his own peers, his own Dominican, he belongs to the Order of Dominicans, an order of St. Dominic committed to truth. I mean, that was the great search of Dominic, to what is the truth, and to preach the truth is the whole mandate of the Dominican order. And he has never, none of his basic theological contentions have been refuted or said they were out of the pale by a group of peer inspectors, as it were, who went through all his works. And he honored the request that he be silent for a year. I heard that on February 3rd there will be a conference in Chicago, and he's going to be the keynote speaker. And that's kind of his first public coming out. They put out a magazine called Creation, bi-monthly. And the first issue after he was silenced, he usually had a column, and they had just a blank page. and just to kind of say, I'm respecting this.
National Catholic Reporter
Peterson
had a wonderful article, his letter to Ratzinger.
Yes, he wrote a very profound, very challenging article, and it was really to the Christian world in a way, but to the office in the Vatican that silenced him, saying, what are you protecting in your silencing? I was just going to say, in the follow-up to Original Blessing, then his latest book is The Coming of the Cosmic Christ. And he's tried in this, to walk through the tradition and lift out what he says are the, what he would see as, even he lists, I think it is 7 or 9 key words that he says if we, he says the simple way to reread the Bible in search of the cosmic Christ. And he takes the word angels, Lord, cloud, glory, wilderness, and evil, and explores those as intimations all the way through Scripture of this presence of the cosmic Christ. And then he goes into the New Testament, that reading from Colossians, and that 6 times in the verses 15 to 20. It's, all things, we say, we read it as everything was created. But if you say all things were created, all things, he says it six times in five verses, 15 to 20, all things. Well, I think most of us Christians have never heard that.
In Greek, it bounces ta pun ta. Six times within. It just bounces up.
So Matthew has tried much more to mediate out of the tradition, something of the new cosmology. Does this make any sense to you at all? I mean, is it just?
It makes a lot of sense for me when I think back in terms of having studied Shaker theology. We talked a little bit about the Shakers and their sense of the Christ Spirit, the continuation, the evolvement, and unfoldment of the Christ Spirit. But on the other hand, from sort of a philosophical perspective, I just have a couple of questions. Where do you see God in this? Is God behind the earth, above the earth, transcendent to the earth, to the cosmos, or is God so enveloped in creation, in God's creation, that there's no creation God?
Well, I don't know. You know, I'm not sophisticated perhaps in lots of ways, but I don't say that all of this is God. That's not my contention. But I say that the source of it all, whatever that mystery is, you know, and we struggle to name it, that's who God is for me. Behind it all. But what helps me a lot now is to think God much more in the words of immanence, presence within, and not above. You know, and this is, I've grown up with this. God's up there somewhere. And I don't say that any kind of facetious way. It deeply embedded in me. You pray and you raise your eyes to heaven, kind of, or something. It just permeates my religious formation that God was, you know, and mighty and great. And I don't want to lose that, because I can't think of anything mightier than a God who could do this. You know, we learned today, like, that our galaxy is something like 100 billion stars, and that there are 100 billion galaxies. if you can, you know, if you can figure out a God bigger than that, we use the language of our Christian God is too small. Little, you know, and what is this? So,
I guess I think of transcendency in some ways is for me the way of saying that we are in relation to something beyond ourselves.
Okay, that's fair, right? But are you also
in a different relation?
But are you also in relation to what is? You know, yeah.
Eminence, I can resonate with, but I, yeah, transcendency doesn't mean something just up floating around. It's going beyond us, beyond us, and making us more a part of, I guess your word would be cosmos. Does Matthew 5 see that as what Jesus Christ is doing, is placing us in relationship with the whole cosmos, with, I haven't read that, with and being, and that is in essence what the incarnation is.
Yeah, he definitely did. He really does. Jesus is a this is just, let me just read a tiny little, he's got a chapter in there from the quest for the historical Jesus to the quest for the cosmic Christ. And he really does deal with Jesus. And I think I'd tell you rather to read this than that I can say it very well. But he really does, you know, Jesus is very central to the whole. But again, it's sort of like, you know, I heard one time when he was talking, and he said he had been invited to come to this church to preach on a Sunday, and he talked about God as mother. And afterwards, everyone, you know, he had this, you know, people said, well, and he said, you know, 364 days of the year, weeks of the year, you hear God Father. And you come once to say, well, maybe that's not a total, you know, image for God, that maybe God is mother, add something, you know. What is that language? It's just image for us. We use the term father, that gives a relational, but mother also, you know, the language is only an effort on our part to understand what we cannot understand. And we get cemented in the language. You know, so he said, you cannot, you know, if you use, and so we're very fearful of losing something. You know, and I guess it's to be free to be, say, what is the new revelation? Without kind of constantly being fearful that we're losing something. At the same time, certainly, Jesus is central, you know. So, where, how you fit that in, and where, and how that even is enlarged in our understanding, the mystery of the incarnation.
Jane, would you say that when Tom Berry says we ought to put the Bible on the shelf for 20 years?
Yeah, now, I really want you to honor that too, you know, that can be so misunderstood, and it's been thrown at him, and he said it in the context of understanding. Huh?
Yeah. Does he mean, I mean, certainly he would, out of his own tradition, have great value for the fact that the human community is we are all myth makers, and we are, in a sense, contained by
our mythology.
Our mythology,
yes.
Our myth making, our stories. Contained, defined, energized, identity, and so forth. Is he saying that by saying that I put the Bible on the shelf for 20 years, is he saying that those stories, those myths, are not large enough to inform us, or is he saying that we're so hopelessly unable to relate to them in their depth that we just we just need to put it on the shelf for a while until we can come back to it in a new way?
I think it's your first contention that the myth, you know, the story, at this point, I'm putting words in his mouth, but it would be something like, it confines us in a way that we are not free to take the revelation, what is being revealed, and just explore it. The myth that we're living by is too narrow, and, well, I shouldn't say that, but if we continue to stay within it, we are not willing to take in new information as it just in its own righteousness, in its own rightness, and grapple with it. So the Bible, the kind of the context of that comes out of a very different era, a very different understanding. And it's sort of, let us just be open to what science is revealing to us, and then come back to our book, surely. Then see where how our myth will look.
Maybe it's like taking a walk through the woods, or just walking through your life, looking for sermon illustrations instead of kind of seeing things as they are.
Oh, who does that?
A few of us. Well, I'm just going to sort of follow up on that was, I was thinking about sermon illustrations too, but in terms of interpreters of scripture need to look more, I think, at the margins of the text that we have, the book that we have before us, and if we can find, if we indeed have some sense that God is confined inside the covers of that book, then we, I think we should chuck it for 20 years, that it has no power. But I don't think I would, I don't, for myself, I don't have any sense that God is confined in that way. I have a question sort of a little bit arising out of the question of myths and out of the talk about dualisms yesterday, and I was wondering if Barry or if you have thought, or Matthew Fox, I guess I've read Barry, I haven't read Matthew Fox, think in terms of triadic realities. I mean, I am really, I think that we have not begun to exhaust the sense of the Trinity in Christian tradition. I think that is such an imaginative construct and also reality that I think that we could do a lot more with that in terms of cosmology and
Well, isn't that interesting?
God and
that's what Tom even says. Is this differentiation, interiority, and communion? Is that the new cosmological model for the Trinity?
Did he say that?
What was that again? The three words?
You know, differentiation, that the sacred, it presence, interiority, the subject, you know, each, and dwelling in communion. You know, that we have a familial model. We talk Father, Son, Spirit.
Right? We also have that model very much too. I mean, that's just a slight rewording of that.
Well, a psychological model, thought thinking upon itself, evoking and evolving, you know, and love uniting. I mean, we are the models, but like, so it's like every, again, that same thing. Every generation brings to the book its own set of questions. And struggles to redefine in light of new information. But I, you know, yeah.
I don't know, I'll be brief about this. I guess I also see the word as being not just contained within covers, but being alive and dynamic and evocative. And in another sense, it's not just, I hear you saying it's the context that needs to be changed, the cosmology. And I guess I feel it's entirely possible, and I've seen it happen, that the word becomes evocative within a new context, a new cosmology, where it takes on a whole new meaning. I'll be really brief with an example. We had a women's retreat this last fall that I had mentioned, and my wife had talked about the beginning of, you know, the universe and the wonderful video that you've shown us. She explained that to the women, and then one of them, somehow in the conversation, got to the biblical description of our being created from the earth, and she said, that just doesn't quite fit for me sometimes. And my wife said, well, I prefer to see us as being made up of stardust, you know, and the difference significant for this person, because she had been sexually abused as a child repeatedly, and it was suddenly her whole life took on a different value from that. And that's just a simple illustration. And I think there, you know, I think that can happen in a very evocative sort of way.
Well, I hear what you're saying, and it makes sense, but I don't know in what sense it makes sense. That is, it makes sense, actually, to put the Bible on the shelf. If the Bible, if the Christian West has produced what we have produced, then it makes sense to put something on the shelf for a while and look at it. I mean, not look at what has produced it, although we should look at that, but to look at what we have produced. And that's what I hear you saying. We've got to look at the world, look at nature. But I'm not sure that looking at nature will tell us what to produce. I mean, the framework of looking at what we have produced and its effects on nature would certainly question what we have found in the, what we, the Christian West, have found in the biblical tradition, insofar as that's created us. But I don't know that looking at nature will tell us what to produce or what to be.
Well,
so,
this
so that I think it makes all the sense in the world, but I'm not sure that one can expect the framework of an interrelated world to tell us what to be today, tomorrow, and tomorrow's tomorrow.
Well, so, give it a chance. That's all I'm saying. Because we've broken with that. We've broken with that. And we don't believe it, and we don't know how, and of course we don't.
And I don't think the primitive, well, maybe the primitive Native American Hopi lifestyles. I do believe that traditional societies have a lot to tell us. I really believe that modernity is no great gift. It's a gift and not a gift. And traditional societies are a gift and not a gift. Some combination is desirable, some of you know. But just how that happens, I don't think it's given automatically by a framework in which you either take traditional society as the image for reality of what it ought to be, or you take natural reality as the image for what our lives ought to be. I don't think it just emerges from that. Important though it be to look more at what is happening in nature. Now you could take nature as a kind of feedback, or you could take nature as somehow embodying within itself what's real. And I'm certainly going with the feedback thesis, but I don't know about finding in nature, because nature is full of all kinds of destructive and all kinds of forces that are dark and not so dark, as well as forces of light.
I wanted to agree with that in the way I've been, in your description. I've tried Thomas Berry. I just get in a lot more with Matthew Fox, and just to say an appeal to, let's not have either or. I mean, why must we have either or? I agree, yes, let's get some distance from the Bible. We need to distance ourselves from it in the same way that dramatists in the 30s recognized the value and drama of distancing yourself from this representational reality so that you can come to a deeper reality. And having come from a fundamentalist background, I understand that probably far more than a lot of you who didn't. We need that, but must we talk about God as mother, blah, 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 and not mix them together in order to get the balance back? If we're imbalanced because we've ignored one at the expense of the other, for heaven's sake, let's not spend 20 years exploring the next one at the expense of the other. Let's get together, you know? I mean, that's just my two. Maybe I just like Matthew Fox because he's a Dominican and it means dog of God, and I find that really exciting. So.
There are voices today who suggest that part of our problem is that we've never taken the Bible off the shelf. And that's particularly a critique of the Roman Catholic community. That it would be nothing for them to put it back on the shelf because they never took it off. I heard a diatribe on that the other day. And the Protestant Christianity has been so ensconced by other values that when they look at the Bible, they make out of it purely what they want to make out of it anyway. And so there's a sense, even though they hold it up all the time, It's been better if they would have left. And so those are kind of interesting discussions.
Right, all right, that's good.
Are floating around. I mean, for example, fundamentalism, I mean, which uses the Bible for its own purposes, is a relatively recent phenomenon in our midst, arising out in juxtaposition to the whole scientific era. But beyond that, nobody was ever a fundamentalist. At least, maybe they were. There was some sense of fundamentalism in the early church fathers in terms of interpreting parables in allegorical fashion or something. I don't know, is that fundamentalism? I don't know, and that others argue that part of the problem is that we don't have stories that inform us anymore that are very large, and so we are at sea with anything over against which to dialogue mythologically. Yes. We don't have an investment, and that maybe to push us further at sea without cultural stories is might lead us down some really could lead us down some really destructive kinds of paths. It would be really interesting to have Tom, push us at length on that particular issue.
There was an issue of the, it's a theological journal published in London called The Way, and it was all on Christian spirituality January of this year, and I did a piece in it on Christian spirituality and social justice, and Brian Swim did one, and different people were invited to give. And there's a Jesuit by the name of Thomas Clark, a theologian living in New York, and very respected in the Roman Catholic community. And he edits one of the books you have on your shelf over there. So, but anyhow, this summer, Tom Barry and Tom Clark are going to come together, because Tom Clark's article in The Way said, it was a review of review of both Barry and Matt Fox, and he says in it that, compelling as the vision is that Tom puts out, does it have within it the same, really compelling vision that the redemption, the story of the death and resurrection of Jesus, has as a carrying mythology or a theme. And they're going to be together this summer at a colloquium up at this retreat center in Canada, just to have that conversation back and forth. And that will probably be taped and everything. So for me anyhow, it will be a very central discussion.
I think the paradigm that Matthew Fox lifts up for us in The Cosmic Christ has some really interesting dimensions, because if you look at, understand what he's doing there, asking what was Jesus' relationship, for example, at one point to the cosmic Christ. If we're talking about that psychologically, we talk about what is the content of the archetype called the Christ, which existed long before Jesus.
And
Jesus had a relationship to it, and it continues to exist today. And the question then is, how do we relate to that archetype? How did Jesus relate to it, historical Jesus? And then he, suggests that part of the problem is we're so consumed with the historical Jesus, we don't get on to the question of what is our relationship to the Christ today. I find that a kind of helpful paradigm to work in.
Yeah. See, and that is true, Scott. I think that each discipline will take that. That's a psychological cut on it.
Right, that's a psychological cut.
Right, right. But he says, Matt Fox says, the cosmic Christ is the divine mystery and miracle of existence laid bare in the unique existence of each atom, each galaxy, each tree, bird, fish, dog, flower, star, rock, and human. The cosmic Christ is the I am in all of creation. I am. Within that blade of grass.
There's a paradigm that comes out of the Bible, or comes out of our story, that I think can be really helpful.
But the second person of the Trinity is the cosmic Christ. We've got all the instruments for dealing with this.
You don't.
Logos.
You really don't. Because you don't have interiority in any very profound way. There's some kind of sense of, mystical sense in which you see God in everything, but it's only out of the experience of learning how to hear the creation through science that you really begin to understand how profoundly that has affected things. When you think of an experiment in which a particle goes through a slit, and when it does, it behaves in a certain way. It's like a particle, it goes right through and strikes something on the other side. But when you put another slit beside it, that particle behaves entirely differently. It knows which slit it went through. It knows whether another particle has gone beside it. That there is a sense of communication between things as tiny as particles. There's nothing of that. In the Bible, there's no way in which you get a real that you know how to even hear those kinds of things about creation, because theologists and theologians they have no, well, as you talk about hell, they have no ability to hear the voice of the earth. I thought that was a really profound thing that you were telling us.
Well, some do and some don't. No, I mean, if you take the process theologian, they come out of a view of reality that's the kind of reality that you're talking about. I mean, there certainly is a plethora of different responses to reality that we have in our traditions. Some are not very strong, but they're there. The question of choice always is to what interpretation and what grounding one accepts in one's theology. I certainly have been living for 50 years out of Alfred North Whitehead, and his interpretation of physics, which at least moves in the direction that you're talking about here.
Carl Jung's critique, of course, was that the Trinity was a limiting factor, wherever that notion came from, and that where we needed to get to was a quaternity. Of course, he saw quaternities everywhere, in the mandala. And the missing link for him was earth and the feminine.
Right, Jerry was who said we have 14 dimensions, didn't he?
But I mean, in the best, even in the best sense of Lutheran theology, the word was a notion that it was supposed to be much larger than the Bible. The word was never equal to the Bible in good Lutheran theology. Mm-hmm. Here I'm defining good Lutheran. But the Bible was
creed.
Or a testimony to. And And someplace along the line, Revelation, one of the really interesting papers I read when I was studying at the Jung Institute was by a Roman Catholic priest who did a study of Mormonism, and who's the founder?
Joseph Smith.
Anyway, one of his contentions in that psychological analysis, historical analysis of Joseph Smith, was that one of the things that gave rise to the phenomenon called Joseph Smith was the fact that in Protestantism, the notion that revelation had stopped with the writing of the scriptures was in full bloom. And that Joseph Smith essentially came along and said, hey, revelation ain't stopped, I just got one.
I would hate for us to focus on the defensiveness of the Bible, though I would like to focus on the offensiveness of creation spirituality. What is it saying to us, really saying to us? That's what I'd like to focus on. Because we need to hear some voices about what is being said to us today. And not worry too much about the frameworks, out of what it's coming, because we each have our own framework, and we'll probably continue to have our own frameworks, but we have to listen more to the creation. So if the creation spirituality has something to say to us, I want to hear it. I really want to hear it. I don't know how you are, but I want to hear it loud and clear. That's what I'm hoping to hear.
I tried.
Keep hoping to, well, but more than the framework, I want to hear the word. The word has got to be much more concrete than I've heard yet, from my point of view. And I realize that there are two ways to look at what needs to happen. One is a kind of patient, emerging change of consciousness, and out of it something will come. And the other is a much more concrete. And I realize I'm...
Tomorrow morning, right.
Yeah. I'm on the concrete side.
Right, yeah.
I mean, I'm on both sides, but I'm much more, I think, on the concrete side. But at least I know that there are two kind of perspectives.
Anyhow, it's time for coffee.
Thank you.
As they say in Ghana, I did my possible.
You did your possible.
You did your possible.